Before we get into the report and discussion, Paul Howard had a few comments.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to take this opportunity to recognize and thank Chad Demarest for his many years of support to the council and council staff. Chad's been with us off and on for about 10 years, mostly on, and he recently left us at the beginning of this month, and he's now working for the Northeast Fisheries Science Center. As you know, Chad helped us with ground fish and initial decision documents and has helped many of our plans with early habitat and was instrumental in moving us through phase one with our habitat amendment. So Chad has left, and I want to say thank you for all your hard work, Chad, and wish you the very best in your new assignment. He won't be going far. He's going to work on the habitat and chair the PDT for a few more months anyway, and as we transition to Michelle and you know, we get going again with the habitat. So I'd like to give a round of applause for Chad. Thanks, Chad.
Any parting remarks? Okay.
He'll be back.
Okay, I'll turn it over to Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also would like to thank Chad. He's been like the Energizer Bunny. I think everybody knows what I mean by that. And frankly, if this were a military organization, I would insist that we get a stop-loss order on him, keep him from going anywhere. But I have no control over that, so I would like to thank Chad for all that he's done and wish him well and hope that he soon finds his way back. we'll sure have a place for him. The habitat report is behind tab 7, and there are really three things we're going to do today. I know we're already running an hour behind on schedule, and we haven't even hit anything controversial yet, so I want to move this as quickly as possible. There are really three things that we need to look at today. One is the letter to proposed persons of concern for offshore energy projects or any other type of non-fishing project that may impact on fisheries. The second is Chad's part of the report, which will be an update on the SASE 2.0 model that he's been working on and that the PDT has produced. And his report will be as a result of the SSC peer review and the changes that have been made as a result of that review. And the third thing is a policy decision that I want to present to you when we get done. So first of all, item number 3 behind tab 7, I hope you've all had a chance to look at it. I'm not going to take the time to read it. I normally would, but again, we're behind schedule. I'd like to this letter is designed specifically to be sent to any persons of concern for any proposals that may have an impact on fisheries, and it's the result of a council directive to the Habitat Committee to produce such a letter to assist in consultation, which we're required to provide to people who are proposing any project that may impact fisheries. We're required to provide that consultation under MSA. They are also required to cooperate under MSA with us in that consultation and to take into account our input as to inputs on fisheries. The letter was intended to increase the efficiency of that process and to thereby better protect essential fish habitat by making sure that everybody knew up front what was expected and what their obligations were, and that we were willing to help them to meet those obligations. And I would like to specifically also here thank Lou Chiarella because he made some additions to this letter that considerably strengthened it and made it much more pointed. So having said that, does anybody have any comment or questions regarding this letter? Any changes anybody would like to see? Hopefully none. Everybody's had a chance to look at it. Any comments? Yes, Paul.
Dave, I think the letter is great, but how do we, what triggers, when is it triggered to send it, and would the Michelle and you will be looking at as proposals come forward and
The intent here is that these proposals are usually quite public for a number of very good political reasons. They're usually quite public, and they're coming in an increasing blizzard. There are a lot of wind energy is the big one right now, but there are a lot of them being proposed off of Maine and off of Rhode Island as well. And the idea here is that as soon as we get wind of one, then we get a letter out right away to whoever the persons of concern are. Did you want to add to that, Chad, at all? That's basically the way it's working. Okay, any other comments? Yes, said Dr. Pierce. Well, sorry.
On page 2 of the letter, just a clarification, David, that's all. On page 2 of the letter, you note that we're listing baseline data, regional setting analysis information that's consistent with the services Habitat Conservation Division requirements. So number 1 and number 2 are consistent with those requirements, and my question is, the other issues to consider include all of those bullets. Are those also specific requirements that are listed by NIMS through the Habitat Conservation Division, or is that something new?
They're not specific requirements. What they are is the PDT and the committee listed out what they thought would be the kinds of things that people should be looking at, and they're suggestions really. They're not specific requirements. And in any particular proposal, they may not all apply. And there may be others that aren't listed that might apply. But it's an intention to help people to focus their efforts, really. Make the whole thing more efficient.
Any other questions on the letter? Paul Howard.
Just, Dave, it would be more appropriate to strike Habitat Conservation Division and just call them National Marine Fisheries Service requirements as opposed to...
Yeah, that's fine with me. Yeah,
okay.
So this letter would be our standing boilerplate letter.
Yes, it would. In fact, there would be nothing. We don't want to put this in stone. If there is a particular proposal that may require different bullets or a change in bullets, this is a form letter that we can work from.
Yep.
So we have something ready to go, and we don't have to reinvent it every time, because these proposals are starting to come in really fast, and it's really time consuming, particularly for Chad and people in the on the Habitat committee to start from scratch every time one of these comes in.
I read the letter last week. I think it's a good boilerplate letter, and I don't see any problems with it.
Okay. Any? We all set then? We don't need a motion on this, do we?
Anything further from the council on this issue, Dave?
Okay. Then the next thing is the SASE model that used to be called the FIGSE model, but people didn't like that word. I liked it, but nobody else did. The SASE model has been developed considerably beyond what was presented to you at the meeting, what is it, 2 meetings ago. And so Chad now is going to give you an update on that and how it's going to be applied. Chad, take it away.
All right, we'll see how this goes. A little gunshot here. All right. So, assuming I can figure out how to advance the slides. There we go.
This is okay, just like that.
Yeah? You sure? Because after Maggie's experience, I don't know. It's a little dodgy. I want to talk about 2 things, basically. I want to talk a little bit about the concept of essential fish habitat, because a lot of times I perceive that there might be some lack of clarity in how the Omnibus Amendment was set up and in the basis for the adverse effects analysis or assessment that the PDT is doing. And then the second thing is to get everybody up to speed on the model that we're creating and how it can potentially be used to help the committee and the public and the council to craft alternatives and evaluate them. So my objectives are to make a case for considering essential fish habitat and HAPC designations primarily in the context of non-fishing project impacts and consultations. The basis for this, a lot of times we'll hear at PDT meetings, at committee meetings, people from the public, people from the committee say, well, you know, that's not essential, or how do we know that that's essential, and et cetera, et cetera. And I'm going to kind of make a case for why that's maybe not the appropriate question when it comes to essential fish habitat. And the second thing is to explain the SASE model and get everybody, hopefully, as up to speed as we are on how the model is developed, what it means, and how it can be used. So these are my deep thoughts on EFH. Hopefully a lot of this is background, but there we go. The Magnuson Act requires FMPs to describe and identify EFH for every fishery. I actually kind of get a kick out of the word fishery there because the final rule requires EFH designation to every species and life stage. And that seems to be substantially different to me, but that's the way it is interpreted, so there you are. To minimize to the extent practicable the adverse impacts of fishing on EFH, to list the major prey species for the species in the fishery management unit and discuss the location and identify non-fishing activities that may adversely affect EFH. So those are the four things that the FMPs have to do with regards to EFH. So forget about that. That's part of a prior slide. That little animation should have gone away. The final rule requires EFH designations for each life stage, species and life stage. It introduces the concept of habitat areas of particular concern and specifies requirements for minimizing to the extent practicable the adverse effects from fishing on habitat. So, didn't think there was going to be a quiz here, did you? One of the first things that I explored with the PDT and with the committee when I first was assigned to the Habitat PDT to try to figure out what the role of EFH designations and adverse effects analyses were in the great scheme of things. I mean, are we trying to promote environmental protection? Are we trying to promote fishery productivity? Are we just doing it to check off the box? And one of the first things that I did was go to the Act itself and kind of do a word search on essential fish habitat and find out what they were trying to get at when they crafted this bit of legislation. So from the findings and declarations that precede the Act itself, you've got a national program for the conservation and management of the fishery resources of the United States is necessary to prevent overfishing, rebuild overfish stocks, ensure conservation, and facilitate long-term protection of EFH, and to realize the full potential of the nation's fishery resources. So EFH protection here is on the same ladder rung as overfishing and everything else. It is protecting essential fish habitat, one could interpret, for the sake of protecting essential fish habitat. It is a goal in and of itself, not necessarily a tool to achieve a separate goal. The second reference to EFH in the findings and declarations for the Act is to promote the protection of essential fish habitat in the review of projects conducted under federal permits, licenses, or other authorities that affect or have the potential to affect such habitat. That's pretty cut and dry, right? They're trying to get EFH into the Act because they want to make sure that people that are going to be doing sand and gravel mining or offshore wind farms or oil rigs or whatever in the marine environment, there's some entree that the Fisheries Service has to comment on the impacts of those projects on fish habitat, on the things that the fish need to live, to thrive. So the final rule has these four levels of data for designating habitat, essential fish habitat. So the four levels are specified here straight from the final rule. The graphic on the left is mine, right? So level one distribution data are available. Level two, habitat-related densities of species are available. When you get down to level three, level four, you're talking about growth, reproduction, survival rates within habitats, and production rates by habitat are available. I interpret that level one, level two is more directly applicable for the habitat protection, the offshore other non-fishing uses of marine services mission, whereas if you get to the level three, level four types of data and you have those data available, that's going to support the use of essential fish habitat in fishery production much better. So do broad or narrow designations better serve the intent of the Magnuson Act in the fishery? One example, the Pacific Fishery Management Council designated for all of their species and life stages, for all of the fish in their fishery management units, all waters from a particular within a particular depth band. I think it's like 50 meters down to 1,500 meters, right? Pretty cut and dry, pretty simple. They do not have different maps for each life stage and each species. They do not have 68 different descriptions of EFH. EFH is from here to there. And if their main concern is to have the broadest possible geographic distribution of marine non-fishing projects to comment on, then they accomplish that very well, because any project that happens between those depth bands in their waters affects every species and life stage, EFH, designated EFH in their fishery. If they are trying to use an EFH designation to somehow promote the productivity of a fishery resource, well, they haven't been very specific, right? That would be kind of difficult. But I have yet to see a council discussion, either at the Mid-Atlantic or the New England councils, which are the two that I'm most familiar with, where somebody said, I think that the quota for this stock should be 3,400 metric tons, but quick, let's check the EFH map first. So I don't think that the EFH designations have really served a fishery management purpose at the council level in the past. So if the environmental protection is the primary utility of EFH designations, then the broad designation will allow more consultations on more projects and probably serves that role pretty well. If fishery production is the primary utility, then you're going to want to look at more narrow designations, right, that are going to translate into more focused fishery management measures to protect vital habitats. At this time, I would make the case that the data is not sufficient to support measures that are that specific. So the EFH provisions serve these dual purposes, this environmental protection role and fishery productivity enhancement role. And the relationship between these two things is not very clearly defined. And I've had these discussions with the Habitat Office at Silver Spring as well. And when I say that this is not the delineation here, or the, you know, these things are not kind of defined in a hierarchical perspective, that's I think a pretty well agreed upon fact. I mean, there's no clear-cut answer here. Absent better data, the EFH designations are probably best serve an environmental protection role, and as evidence of that, I would offer that NOAA's Habitat Conservation Division and the proponents of projects that, you know, would relate to the letter that we just talked about, those are the people that consume our EFH designations. Those are the people that really care about our EFH designations. And so attempts to use EFH designations for the fishery productivity role, if we were to ever get to level 3, level 4 data, it might result in geographically constrained EFH designations that would compromise the consultation utility. So if we were to develop, if there was a research plan that was in place that was geared towards developing level 3, level 4 data that was going to be kind of habitat-specific production rates, and we were going to start to look at using EFH to help guide fishery management decisions, doing that would be a strategic decision that might compromise the Habitat Conservation Division's ability to consult on projects, right? Because you're going to get a more geographically constrained definition of EFH. So I think if we were to ever get there, the council would be wise to have a strategic discussion as to how they want to use EFH. But at this time, you know, A, that research plan is not in place that I'm aware of, and B, those data don't exist that I'm aware of. So I am trying to make the case that it's probably best to think of these EFH designations think of the customer as being the Habitat Conservation Division who we're trying to support in commenting on non-fishing impacts. So HAPCs are a little bit different because they are supposed to be an area that, you know, there's four requirements that we're supposed to assess the proposed HAPCs by, and if they meet those four requirements, then the council may designate an area as an HAPC. But the underlying kind of data layer for HAPCs is that it has to be designated EFH for something. So given that level 1, level 2 data are used in the EFH designations currently, and that these data, I am arguing, are more appropriate for environmental protection for that role, the most efficient use of the EFH provisions Should the HAPCs, which we did in phase one of the Omnibus Amendment, should that be the starting point for an adverse impacts assessment? I mean, have we already decided where the areas where adverse effects are most likely to occur from fishing are because we've voted on those HAPCs? Or should we use those HAPCs as an attempt to raise the profile of particular areas with a focus on those consultations? You know, these are the areas where we don't want to see sand and gravel mining, or these are the areas where we don't want to see wind farms or oil platforms or oil exploration. And I think it should be fairly obvious that I would argue for the latter. And I think that the Council's actions and the Committee's actions speak to that as well. I mean, if we intended the HAPCs to be the be-all and end-all for fishery management regulations, then we wouldn't have embarked on Phase 2 to begin with. We wouldn't have needed to do an adverse effects of fishing on EFH assessment because we would have already answered the question, where do we care about? But because we went down this road and we are going down this road and trying to answer the question, which areas do we care about, with the adverse effects from fishing in mind, I don't think that the HAPCs are the appropriate starting point for that particular role. And here's an example. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to use this or not, but one of the first things that happened to me after my surgery, and I was on probably a tremendous amount of OxyContin at the time, was John Papalotto sent me a couple of very urgent emails saying I need to know where EFH is, and I mean, I don't think it was the OxyContin talking, but it's everywhere, you know. And where are the HAPCs? And we had to decide whether we were talking about proposed HAPCs or existing HAPCs. And the reason for this was because the Congress was, or I think it was the House, was looking at the moratorium on oil exploration, and they wanted to know where EFH was and where HAPCs were. And those are the two things that they cared about. They didn't care about where the closed areas were. They didn't care about where, you know, the rotating closures were. They wanted to know about HAPCs and EFH. They have some sort of saliency at that level, and they make some sense at that level. So, again, this is a very good real-life example of how those can be used in the non-fishing consultation role for environmental protection of fish habitat without having to get too wrapped up in, but what areas are essential? I mean, if we're using the survey data as a proxy for where fish like to live, you know, is that really appropriate? Well, I'm not sure that that's a question that really needs an answer at this point. It probably needs a research program, but it's okay that we're not answering that question to any great degree right now. So when I gave this presentation to the Mid-Atlantic 2 weeks ago, I just kept talking, and I had probably put most of the room to sleep by now, but at this point I think I'd prefer to take a break, or at least I got some feedback that said I should take a break, and take some questions if anybody has any on that part of it. And that's the controversial subject. Like, if that puts you to sleep, then the rest of today is going to be really bad.
Any questions for Chad? Sally?
I guess I don't quite follow the logic on using HAPCs as a starting point for consultations that the council might be involved with non-fishing activities, and EFH being the starting point for dealing with fishing impacts. Or maybe I'm not understanding what you said correctly. So you're shaking your head, so why don't you explain that again?
I would argue that they should be thought of in the exact same way, that EFH – the designating EFH allows the service and the council to comment on primarily through the NEPA process for particular stocks and species. The service has an obligation to comment, but otherwise we kind of comment as a general member of the public on non-fishing impacts. So if you've got EFH and it's everywhere and somebody wants to put a wind farm, say, on Horseshoe Shoals, we can go back and say, okay, well, here's the stocks, right, that have designated EFH here. Oh, but by the way, we also designated that area as an HAPC. That affords it with some additional, you know, kind of double secret probation-ish level of care, you know. So an EFH gets you the entree to comment. If somebody were to put or were to propose a wind farm in an area that had no EFH designations whatsoever, then the service and the council are out of luck. We can go to meetings and participate as members of the public, but we don't actually have the Magnuson Act to help us out. If we have it as designated EFH, then we have the Magnuson Act to help us out a little bit, and if we have it designated as an HAPC, we have it to help out a little bit more. I guess that's all I'm saying.
Any other questions for Chad? Dave?
I don't think it's a question as much as a comment. It should be noted that cumulatively, EFH is everywhere. But on a species-by-species basis, it's not anywhere near close to everywhere. So that people would actually have to comment vis-a-vis the species involved. And that's a pretty important distinction.
That's a very important distinction. And that's another real-life example of where EFH has mattered to people. At the second-to-last PDC meeting, we had a group of consultants from, I think it was, Michelle, who was it? EPA?
ACOE?
Okay. Army Corps of Engineers in New York City had taken issue with our proposed maximum depth for winter flounder eggs, which are adhesive, right? So the depth range changed from 5 meters to 20 meters, and that meant that – it's not meters?
Yes, meters.
Meters. Okay, good. At least I'm halfway right. That changed the dredging requirements for the channels in New York Harbor. If the maximum depth that these adhesive eggs go down to is 5 meters, then the bottom of the channel is not designated EFH for winter flounder eggs. If it goes down to 20 meters, then the bottom of the channel is, and every time they dredge, an EFH consultation is required. Just an absolutely perfect example of people that care about our EFH designations. You would never have a similar discussion when we talk about ACLs and AMs, right? So that's my point.
Mary Beth?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question. I mean, you've characterized HAPCs and how we could use them, you know, areas of particular concern, but there's no mention of the habitat closed areas. I mean, we have huge closed areas. How would you characterize that?
Well, I'm making the case for separating the two missions. So the Magnuson Act has those four things that we're required to do. One of them is to designate EFH, and the other is to minimize, to the extent practicable, the adverse effects of fishing on EFH. And I think that those two things should be thought of separately. And I think that EFH and HAPCs are excellent tools for the non-fishing consultation side. But when it comes to fishing impacts on habitat, think of that separately, and that's where the habitat closures come in. So those are there to minimize, to the extent practicable, the adverse effects of fishing on EFH. And then the question is, you know, how are we doing it at minimizing, to the extent practicable, the adverse effects? Where should we think about minimizing? What types of gear types should we look at? But that's, I think, a separate discussion from designating EFH and from designating HAPCs.
Anyone else? Okay, put us to sleep, Chad.
I can do it. All right. So now we'll talk about that separate discussion, assessing the adverse effects from fishing on EFH to the extent practicable. So this is where the little thing makes a little bit more sense, because that's what I'm actually going to talk about this time. So the final rule says an adverse effect means any impact that reduces the quality and or quantity of EFH. Well, that's great, but what's good for some species is bad for others. So that doesn't provide a whole lot of guidance. If we've got 68 species in life stages, and some of them, for example, like structured habitat or like divots in the mud, and you create a divot in the mud, then you've done something great for habitat. Or if some of them don't like divots in the mud, then you create a divot in the mud and you've got an adverse effect. It's very difficult to take some of these very broad definitions and apply them across all of our species and life stages. So we've made a lot of simplifying assumptions in going forward with what is important and what we're going to try to assess. Councils must act to prevent, mitigate, or minimize any adverse effect from fishing to the extent practicable if there's evidence that a fishing activity adversely affects EFH in a manner that is more than minimal and not temporary in nature. So that's our objective. More than minimal, we have to figure out what more than minimal means and what's not temporary in nature. And hopefully our little SASE model here can help us get to there. Loss of prey may be an adverse effect on EFH. I'm not going to read the rest of that because the first sentence is really the most important. We included prey. We did a prey species evaluation in phase one, right? And we could have just ended with that and probably met the letter of the law for the Magnuson Act. But the final rule says that loss of prey may be an adverse effect on EFH, so we've incorporated prey as a habitat type in our assessment. Adverse effects to EFH may result from actions occurring within EFH or outside of EFH. So we're not constraining ourselves to areas that are designated EFH for any species or life stage when we're talking about this assessment. We're looking at the entire management operating area that the council is responsible for. And the reason that we're doing that is because of this particular line in the final rule. So here are the objectives from phase two that the council set 16 years ago or whenever this whole thing got started. Identify all major fishing threats to EFH of those species managed by the council. Identify and implement mechanisms to protect, conserve, and enhance the EFH of those species managed by the council to the extent practicable. Define measurable thresholds for achieving the requirements to minimize adverse impacts to the extent practicable. And integrate and optimize measures to minimize the adverse impacts to EFH across all managed species, all managed FMPs. Those last two, I think were really kind of foundational in the approach that the PDT started down and has continued down over the last year and a half. We're trying to come up with a tool that is measurable. It could be used in a kind of a threshold way and integrates across all of the different FMPs and all the different gear types that are used in fisheries that are regulated by the New England Fishery Management Council. So March of 2008 is really when we kind of started doing this, so it's been about a little bit over a year. And we wanted to allow the council to compare the impact of different fisheries and gear types using a common currency and to provide insight into which areas are most likely to be vulnerable to adverse effects from fishing. And again, I'm assuming that the HAPCs that were designated in phase one did not set that up for us already, that we were going to take kind of an independent, fresh look at that question. And then how adverse effects from fishing have changed or are changing over time. Because I think that the PDT and the committee think that those are some of the more critical questions that are going to help inform what types of alternatives the council is going to want to consider. So the result of this was, and the joke here is that at the very beginning of this process, probably in like a February 2008 committee meeting, my committee, or I guess it's not my committee, maybe it is now, I'm still a little unclear, Vice Chair Dave Gaisel said, I don't want to see a bunch of gammas and sigmas and pluses and minuses. You know, we want to kind of try to keep this somewhat comprehensible. And so this is what we've given him. We did the best we could. The good news is that all of that is really just kind of not that relevant to what we're talking about here. It kind of boils down to just a couple of different things. A is the swept area that a particular gear has, and that little omega sign is the kind of the effect of fishing on a particular habitat by a particular gear type. So A is the area impacted by a unit of fishing effort times the proportion of the gear in contact with the bottom during normal operation. And omega is a factor adjustment that accounts for the nature of the impact of a particular fishing gear on a particular piece of habitat. So these are the assumptions that underlie the model. We're still trying to come up with more assumptions that underlie the model. I'm sure that we've missed a lot of them, and I'm not going to read them all right now, but they're certainly available, and I'm happy to answer questions or throw one of my PDT members under the bus. There, a number of them are sitting behind me. So to calculate that A variable, it's contact-adjusted area swept, and we just tried to be quite specific about what was touching the bottom by the gears that the council is regulating. We came up with basically 9 different gear types. We've got this kind of generic otter trawl gear type, which is groundfish trawls and scallop trawls and monkfish trawls and fluke trawls. And then disaggregated are shrimp trawls, squid trawls, and raised foot rope trawls. We've got scallop dredge and surf clam motion quahog hydraulic clam dredge. We've got lobster and deep sea red crab traps. And long lines and sink gill nets. So those are the gear types that we are assessing kind of separately. And here is a version of a SASE model for trawl gear where you've got the distance towed, the effective width of the otter board, and the effect. I'll explain. Actually, Michelle did a great graphic that's coming up on the next slide that'll make sense of all this. You've got the effective width of the otter boards, the effective width of the ground cables, the effective width of the sweeps, contact adjustments that factor into each one of those, and basically the contact adjustment is just the proportion of that piece of gear, the proportion of the door that touches the bottom, the proportion of the ground cable that touches the bottom, the proportion of the sweep that touches the bottom. And then you've got that omega, that vulnerability index. So here's what the model kind of looks like. I'm going to try to use the laser, but it might hurt somebody. Sorry. This is the door right there, right? And the door right there. And so you can see the patch of bottom that the door creates when it touches the ground. You've got the ground cables, and you've got the sweep. So this is the proportion of the gear components that are in contact with the bottom at any given time. And so you can kind of you can look at this, and this is relatively to scale. We're assuming a 40-degree angle for the doors and a 15-degree angle for the ground cables. And it comes out to be about 5% of the total area swept of a trawl gear is the doors, about 60 to 65% is the ground cables, and only about 30% is the sweep. And to some extent, this is kind of an interesting thing to put on paper because a lot of people assume intuitively that the sweep is all we're talking about when we're talking about area swept. But in fact, the sweep is not a small percentage, but a smallish percentage. The impact of the gear, the primary impact of the gear is that kind of slicing and cutting action of the ground cables as they go across the bottom. And then the other, one of the other interesting things is that you can see the shape of the sweep is such that if you've got ground gear rollers or rock hoppers that are kind of on the side, you know, they're kind of digging in and not necessarily rolling, whereas they are in the middle, they're rolling. So we're trying to be as specific as possible as we're thinking about the impact of the individual components of the gear. The difference between these two graphics, the bottom one is just has the contact adjustment factored in. And we don't really have any data on contact adjustment. We don't know precisely what proportion of the ground cables are in contact with the bottom at any given time. Likewise, the sweep. So we make some assumptions and we apply them kind of generically and uniformly across the particular gear types. For example, I think about 90% of the ground cable is assumed to be in contact with the bottom during the course of a tow. But for different sweeps, we've got different contact adjustments. For a, for example, for a raised foot rope sweep where you've got drop chains, it's only the drop chains that are in contact with the bottom at any given time. So that would get a contact adjustment of I think it was 0.1 or so. So only 10% of the length of the sweep would be assumed to be touching the bottom at any given time. It might have actually been smaller. I don't remember. But that's how the model is kind of set up. Scallop dredge is very similar. It's the distance towed times the effective width of the widest dredge component times the contact index. And for scallop gears, we're assuming a contact index of 1. And so the gears assumed to uniformly touch the bottom from the outside edge of the shoe to the outside edge of the shoe across the cutting bar. And then the vulnerability index again. So the vulnerability index is kind of an interesting thing to try to wrap your head around. It's the combination of the effects of fishing gear on the functional value provided by a unit of habitat and susceptibility and the recovery in functional value that a unit of habitat will experience after the gear effect is passed, the recovery. Now, again, I said earlier, something that is bad for one species or life stage might be good for another. So trying to apply a uniform vulnerability index is a tricky thing. And what we did was assume that we were looking at some basic habitat functions. The ability to provide food is one function of habitat, and the ability to provide shelter is another. So anything that provides shelter is basically, from the model standpoint, deemed to be good, and anything that destroys or diminishes the quality of the shelter is deemed to be bad. And so susceptibility and recovery vary across habitat components, energy regimes, gear types, and substrates. So to calculate this variable, we kind of built on the matrix-based approach that we did in Amendment 10 and Amendment 13, and hopefully we're doing it a little bit more comprehensively and a little bit more rigorously. And this is certainly in keeping with some of our initial tasking from the committee. This is kind of what they really wanted to see, was this matrix-based assessment of the vulnerability of habitats. So we've got these 9 different gear types. We've got 5 dominant substrate types. This would be mud, sand, gravel, cobble, and boulder. 2 energy regimes, high energy and low energy, and 3 primary habitat components, geological habitat components, biological habitat components, and prey. And the geological and biological are the shelter providing, the reason that we're assessing them is for their shelter providing capabilities, and prey is obviously included for their food providing capabilities there. So we did the literature review, and this will be a bit redundant because we talked about this at the November Council meeting, so you'll heard this a little bit, but we have expanded the literature database since then. We now have 94 studies selected for use based on the relevance to the regional habitats and gears. This is just a little pretty picture of our most recent version of the database. And so we go through and code all of the different pieces of literature for the different habitat components and all of these other variables that affect that omega variable. And here's our subcategories for the geological, biological, and prey. I won't bother to read them all. For energy regimes, like I said, we have high and low energy. Obviously, environments with different energy regimes are created by the flow of water over habitats, and they affect the nature of the gear impact, the loss of functional value. They affect the susceptibility of habitats to fishing gears, and they most definitely affect the rates of recovery. So we came up with a couple of different ways to define high and low energy. First, we're using a critical shear stress model that was developed by UMass Dartmouth that basically takes the models based on the observed flow at the surface. I can't remember the number of nodes, something on the order of 15,000 nodes throughout the operating area, and infers based on research the way that that will translate down to the bottom at different depths. There's no rugosity or slope or there's no nonlinear component of this. It just makes some assumptions basically on how well or how much flow is going to occur at any given point in the operations area or the analysis area. And we are using a threshold of, it's actually 0.194 newton meters squared, which is the speed at which a grain of sand will be mobile. So it's if the daily or biweekly tides will move a grain of sand on average, according to the critical shear stress model, then that area would be coded as high energy. Because the model has no wave action component, and wave action has a very large role in the energetics of the environment, we also have a minimum depth threshold of 60 meters. So if an area is less than 60 meters deep, then it's coded as high energy as well. So the two things, if it exceeds that critical shear stress definition as high energy, and or if it exceeds that or it is less than the 60 meters, then it's high energy. And what's kind of cool is that you can take that 60 meters and go back and look at SMAST video survey data. They code by sand and rippled sand or structured sand, and it corresponds very well. That 60-meter threshold corresponds very well to their observations. It was chosen based on the literature. We're trying to do all of our assumptions based on literature, and where we have data, we're going to do sensitivity assessments so that people can understand, you know, kind of the quality of our assumptions. So, gear effects. Obviously, gear effects are a function of the type of gear used, the quality or degree of contact that gear has with a given habitat, and the functional value provided by that habitat. So, for every combination of gear type and habitat component and energy environment, we're going to assess susceptibility and recovery, and this is the matrix-based assessment. Here's our definitions for susceptibility and recovery. It's all scaled on a 0, 1, 2, 3 scale, and what we mean by this quantitative definition, if the unit of fishing effort reduces the functional value of 25% of the habitat components, the features that gear contacts during a tow or during a unit of fishing effort, then that gets a 1. If it's 25 to 50% of the features are reduced, their functional value is reduced, it gets a 2. And if more than 50% of the features have their functional value reduced, it gets a 3. And then the same logic applies for the recovery values. How fast does that chunk of real estate recover its functional value? And again, for functional value, we're talking about its structure forming function, its ability to provide structure, and its ability to provide food for the prey, species component. So here's a sample matrix. I thought I was the only one that was getting hot up here. This is for generic trawl, gear, and mud habitat, and you can see you've got the different features. We have prey in here. We've got the geological, biological, and prey features here. We try to list the gear effects that apply, that gear type will have on that habitat component, and we do that for a couple of different reasons. One, we want to make sure that everybody in the PDT understands or is on the same page with regard to what action of the gear we're talking about, and also what those susceptibility and recovery definitions are. And we want the public to be able to understand what we were thinking as we were going through and filling out these matrices. We also have kind of a cross-referenced number system for the literature database. So we're going to list which studies apply to which combination of gear type, energy environment, and substrate or biological feature or prey feature, so that if people want to take issue with the conclusions that the PDT has reached, they can go back and read the same studies and say, we think you really blew it. But at least they'll be able to point to the studies that we looked at, and we'll all be on the same page, and we can then have the discussion whether we're interpreting the same study differently or we've just really blown it. Either case, it's good feedback to get. So we're trying to be as kind of specific and transparent as possible in this. There's only one column for susceptibility. We kind of just determined through trial and error and lots and lots and lots and lots of talking that susceptibility was actually independent of the energy environment. The susceptibility of a particular habitat feature to a particular gear didn't necessarily matter whether it was in high energy or low energy. The high energy and low energy really came into play on the recovery value. So we have two columns for recovery, high energy and low energy. And each one of those cells will get filled out with a 0, 1, 2, or 3 by the PDT. This is how we're inferring the biological features to habitat. It's by substrate and energy, and you can see which biological features and which... Yeah, these are the geological. We're supposed to have, well, whatever, I blew that. I'm supposed to have the biological features up there. But anyway, we're inferring the features to habitats by substrate and energy based on the literature. And so you'll be able to go to a table that looks just like this, that in the left-hand column would have all of the biological features, and see which ones we assume occur in which combinations of energy and substrate. So applying this model spatially, we've got, again, these two variables, the contact-adjusted area swept and the vulnerability index, which is the susceptibility and recovery values that come from the matrix. And we try to apply that spatially. So to parameterize the model on the area swept, it's the sum of the linear effective width of the gear components, the outer board sweep cables for an outer trawl, multiplied by the distance the gear travels and the proportion of the gear in contact with the bottom during normal operation. So you need kind of a contact patch and the contact index. So the contact patch, we're using observer data, VTR data, to come up with the size of the doors, the length of the ground cables, the length, the width of the sweep. And incidentally, for those that are curious, the doors and the ground cables are modeled based on observer data because there's no data, no self-reported kind of VTR data for those, but the VTR does include a code for the sweep length, and so we use the sweep length from the VTR to parameterize that portion of the model. And then we categorically specify by gear the contact index. We don't have any data that says, you know, this amount of the gear is in contact with the bottom during normal operation, so we kind of hard code that, and that's certainly a table that will be subject to discussion and debate amongst the advisors and the public, and we're certainly willing to listen to advice from people that know as well or better than some of our PDT members how much of the gear actually does contact the bottom during normal operation. So the omega function is modeled as a linear decay function based on the susceptibility and recovery metric definitions, where this S value determines the proportion of the contact-adjusted area swept that remains as an adverse effect in the years after the toe is made, and the recovery value determines the duration of that effect. So it kind of looks like this, where this would be a very quick recovery, and you've got your three different susceptibility scores, right? So if it's got a high susceptibility, but it recovers very quickly, in year one, 50% of the area swept, contact-adjusted area swept, would kind of enter into the model. If it had a moderate susceptibility, only about 25%, and if it had a low susceptibility, only about 10% would enter into the model, and then in year two, it would all go away. Likewise, if you have kind of a medium duration, it decays over time, and if you've got a long duration, it decays over even longer amounts of time. So basically, the impact of a toe only lasts for so long, and the model is set up that way. If the toe happens in an area where there's highly sensitive, highly susceptible habitats like deep sea corals, then that impact lasts for a very long time, 100 years, something like that. But if it's in a high energy environment where the features aren't severely impacted, the functional value isn't severely reduced by that toe, then it decays very quickly over time, and you can run the model over, you know, 10 years or 50 years or 100 years, and you can see which areas kind of pop out at you as being the most highly susceptible, highly vulnerable to fishing. That's the theory anyway. So each spatial unit has to contain data summarizing the fishing effort and the energy. And those are the impacting actions, and then the impacted surface, the substrate, the biota, and the prey. We've got data on some of these and less so on others. We've got data on fishing effort. We've got the modeled data, the critical shear stress on the flow, and we know the depth, so we can handle that. We know we have some information about the substrates, not nearly as good as we would like. We've got a lot less information on the biota and the prey, spatially resolved data on the biota and the prey, which is why we're inferring the biological features and the prey features to substrates, because we can, with some degree of accuracy, put the dominant substrate onto a map, but we can't with any degree of specificity put the biological features and prey onto a map at the same kind of level of resolution. So you get the left-hand strip there is the substrate map. The middle is the shear stress map, where the blue is high energy and the yellow is low energy, and then the depth, 60 meter, is the red area for high energy. So you'd have to mentally combine the blue and the red and the yellow and the green to get your combined high energy, low energy definition area. So I'll explain a little bit about how this works. We took every piece of data, and we talked about this in November, so I'm not going to go over this too much, but we took every piece of data we could find. The one major change on the basis of the SSC review and a lot of, you know, kind of good-natured jesting was that 42,354 square kilometer boulder down off of Cape Hatteras when we were using the SMAS video, or excuse me, when we were using the trawl survey hangs as a way to proxy hard bottom. We have taken the trawl survey hangs data out of the underlying substrate grid because very validly people have pointed out that it's not always hard bottom that causes a hang. It can be deep mud that causes a hang. It can be lots of different things that cause hangs. So we kind of wanted to sidestep that issue. We're not ready to give up the data set yet because we think there's a lot of value there, but we're still trying to figure out exactly how to get it in. The problem with eliminating it is that our data sources are now narrowed down to the SMAS video survey and the US seabed data set. The US seabed data set is only capable of detecting 3 of our 5 dominant substrates, so they're not capable of detecting cobbles and boulders in any of their data points. And so that limits all 5 of our dominant substrates to the footprint of the SMS video survey, which is a problem, but that's the way it is. We don't have good substrate data. We don't have good habitat mapping throughout the range of our where our fisheries are prosecuted. So this map right here is a close-up of the data points. You can obviously see the outline of the SMS video survey, and then the other data points are US seabed data. So we take those data points, and we put boxes around them such that the lines of the boxes are the point that's closest to that center data point and furthest, and closer to a data point and no other, and you get this kind of unstructured grid. And then this is how the cells, when they're colored by the dominant substrate, this is how it looks. Now, again, the areas outside of the SMAS video survey, you won't see any orange or red because the gear that they were using to do the sampling, either a naturalist dredge or a core sample, if a core sample goes down and hits a rock, it bounces over and samples the mud that's sitting next to it or the sand that's sitting next to it, and it comes up as sand. It's not capable of detecting the rock that was right there that it bounced off of. So you won't see the red stuff outside of the SMAS video survey in our underlying substrate. And so it's going to be up to the PDT to try to help inform how much error, how much bias it's going to create, in the model, because we're inferring the biological and the prey species to these dominant substrates, and if large swaths of real estate are not capable of being coded as cobble or boulder, even if cobble or boulder exist there, then that presents a serious problem that we're going to have to try to figure out the magnitude of. So one of the when I last presented this model in November and also when we presented it to the SSC, one of the kind of interesting features of the model was that there was no way to capture heterogeneity of substrates because we were defining each one of these little grid cells as a dominant substrate. So each grid cell was kind of equal to one, and there was no way of incorporating the impact of heterogeneity. And the literature kind of indicates that areas that are with the high levels of patchiness and a lot of different types of substrates and habitat features are going to recover slower than homogeneous, large sandy areas or that sort of thing, and are going to have a more pronounced impact on the species that live there. And so the SSC, they didn't really direct us to try to figure out how to deal with this, but they did point that out as a not a flaw, but as a an important component of the model that needed to be discussed. And so the PDT went back and thought real hard on ways that we could incorporate this notion of heterogeneity into the model. So what we did, and this also has some benefits in spatial statistics and modeling the fishing effort, or excuse me, just putting the fishing effort into the model, we put in a 10-kilometer square grid over that unstructured substrate grid, and we're going to apply the fishing effort to the 10-kilometer square grid, and then take the percentage within each 10-square-kilometer grid of the dominant substrates that reside in there, and kind of come up with a distribution of substrates, and therefore distribution of S values and R values that would apply to any toe that happened in that 10-square-kilometer grid. The assumption is that the toe would occur in that 10-square-kilometer grid, and that's a better assumption than that it would occur entirely within one of those little tiny unstructured grid cells, right? That if you had a toe that happened, it's going to happen 100% on cobble or 100% on sand. That was obviously not the case, and so this is our way of trying to have it happen, you know, on 80% sand in an area where our data indicate it is 80% sand. So that's how we're thinking about it now. Now, in the case of the data that we've got available, you know, for fishing effort data, we've got VMS, we've got VTR, and we've got observer data, right? The observer data are not representative of the fishery. They typically, well, not typically, the observer data is biased geographically, you know, to the north and actually a little bit to the west, to the east, because it doesn't capture a lot of the mid-Atlantic trawl fisheries, for one thing, and it definitely has focused highly on the U.S.-Canada area. So if you look at the types of vessels that are more likely to be carrying an observer, they're not representative of the fishery as a whole. So you can't just take the observer data and blow it up and expect to get a good look at what the fishery is doing where, even though it has phenomenal spatial resolution. We know where the toe starts, we know where the toe finishes. Pretty hard to argue with that. The VMS data is fantastic to the extent that we have it. There's some problems with a portion of a particular year. And you have to make some assumptions about when fishing is occurring. You know, you've got these data points every 59 minutes or 61 minutes or whatever it is, and you have to make an assumption about whether that pole was a fishing pole or a non-fishing pole. So there is some element of uncertainty that is introduced in the VMS data. It's not like a guarantee. You can't just look at the VMS track and say, well, that's where the boat fished. And then there's the VTR data, where the captains report a stat area and a lat long, for an entire trip, right? And so if you were to just use that lat long, you'd be placing 100% of a trip, which can be 10 toes, can be 20 toes, can be 2 toes, into a very small box, where in fact that trip probably occurred in a lot of very small boxes. And so we're trying to kind of wrestle with all of these things. And so inferring the VTR data, for example, onto these 10-kilometer square grids is probably, you'd have to use the lat long that's reported on the VTR form, and that's probably not a real good idea, because it's probably not representative of the true fishing effort in any 10-square-kilometer grid. So what we might have to do is blow these grids up a little bit, depending on which data source we're using. We can go as low as 10-square-kilometers if we're using VMS or Observer, but we might have to blow it back a little bit to quarter-degree squares or even statistical areas if we're going to use VTR data. All right. Everybody asleep yet? Good. These are some preliminary model outputs, and I'm not going to go over these. Hopefully they're somewhat legible on the printout, but this slide has the nominal otter or the otter board in meters. This is the effective width of each of the gear components. So you've got the otter boards, the ground cables, and the sweeps, and you can look at the difference between the contact adjustment and the nominal for each of the different gear types. This is in meters. Right, and it's I'm going to scroll back to Michelle's really cool graphics so that everybody understands that these numbers are representative of wherever it is of this right here and not this right here. So it's not the total length of the ground cable, it's the effective width of the ground cable. It's the amount that's actually going to get factored into the SASE model. All right, and so, again, the boards and the ground cables are based on observer data that I blew up to the VTR, and the sweeps are based on VTR data. And I include these basically to get feedback. You know, we did this at the Habitat Committee meeting two committee meetings ago, and a member of the public said, something doesn't look right here. And we went back, and it turns out that that member of the public was absolutely right, and there were some huge problems, and we went back and fixed them. So it's an iterative process, and we're just trying to get the information out so that people can help us point out some of the things that might have gone wrong. The next one is just some more kind of descriptive statistics on the different dimensions included for the exact same reason. And then this is the trawl fishing effort, again, included for the same reason. This is the, let's see, we've got the mean contact-adjusted area swept in square kilometers for all of the trawl components by year with standard deviation. So what you can see here is that the tows are getting much shorter, you know, and they're not taking up quite as much real estate as they were in 1996. And that's across all of the different gear types. Well, that's not true. And I look at shrimp, and that's not true. So I'll keep my mouth shut. Moving on quickly, we've got the trawl fishing effort for soak time and number of hauls and hours fished per trip. These are very important variables in the model, so they're included also as kind of a reality check just to make sure that we don't have anything terribly wrong. And then here's kind of a preliminary look at how the data shake out. So this is the contact-adjusted area swept for the generic otter trawl, raised foot rope trawl, shrimp trawl, squid trawl, and then the SASA units, you know, after you apply the susceptibility and recovery, hours fished, and I've got a revenue column in there just for fun. And so that's broken out by those four trawl gear types, and this is the same descriptive data for the scallop fishery. This is both limited entry, limited access, and general category scallop fishery together, so that explains a little bit of the variability in the number of dredges employed and also the width of the dredges. I haven't broken that out here in general category and limited entry, limited access. So same stuff on the scallop and same stuff on the scallop. So, you know, one of the things that stands out markedly is the, you know, the sheer number, the magnitude of the area swept by the scallop fishery versus the trawl fisheries. So here is both trawls and scallop dredges combined, and so this is a good look at the trend over time, kind of going to the question of how is the council doing at minimizing the adverse effects of fishing on habitat over time. And another way of looking at some of this stuff is the vulnerability index that the gears are fishing on typically. So if you, this is taking the areas where the fisheries, where these gear types were used, and looking at the average or the mean vulnerability index that existed in those areas. So you can see that the otter trawl, for example, fishery, on average, fishes on slightly more vulnerable bottom than the raised foot rope trawl. The scallop fishery fishes on slightly more vulnerable bottom than the others. Likewise, shrimp and squid. So it's just another way of kind of looking at some of these data that might help the council look at which particular gear types it should focus on when looking at crafting alternatives. So this is the limited entry scallop dredge fishery by VMS data. This is nominal area swept. This is before incorporating that omega value. But this is a kind of peek at the layer of level of specificity that we can get into with VMS data. It actually blows up much cooler than it does blown out like that. And this is with the unstructured grid. This will be inferred into that 10 square kilometer grid very soon. And then here's a look at, this is also in the unstructured grid before it gets inferred based on the new method. This is generic otter trawl in SAS units for 2006. So you can look at the areas that had high amounts of fishing effort and were most vulnerable to that fishing effort. And so one of the things that stands out is, you know, the channel, for example, obviously had a lot of fishing effort, but because it was a high-energy environment, that fishing effort decays very quickly and, you know, has kind of a less vulnerable component to it. And vice versa, the kind of the deeper areas become potentially more vulnerable. So How is this going to help for alternative development? You know, the maps and matrices will provide the public and the committee and the council some sort of an objective tool for assessing adverse effects. Gear-specific representations of susceptibility and recovery will provide the committee and the council some insight into which areas are most likely to be vulnerable to adverse effects from fishing. And this kind of realized fishing effort, either plugging in hypothetical amounts of fishing and running it over time or plugging in actualized fishing effort and running it over time will have provide some insight into how things might change. The plugging in actualized fishing effort is a bit of a tricky thing because we've got data that goes back basically to 1996, but we've got a fishery that goes back a couple years further than that. And so we're not making any assessment on, virgin bottom or what the bottom is supposed to look like. In fact, I think you can assume, and one of the benefits of the decay function within the model is that you can look at the areas where fishing effort goes away, you know, over time. And are those areas the ones that continue to be productive? And are there potentially is there a production loss in areas where the model indicates that fishing effort will accumulate over time, the adverse effects of fishing effort will accumulate over time? And I don't know how this all plays out, but if we, when we finally finish coding all this stuff and putting it into GIS and we have these areas that emerge as areas where the adverse effects of fishing accumulate very strongly over time in the model, and those areas end up being highly productive, you know, fishing areas where there's a lot of fish around, well, then that's going to tend to kind of undercut any of the validity of the model. And if the opposite happens, then that might actually lend some credence to the model. Like I said, I don't know how it plays out. But I think there's some really interesting components to this that are going to be kind of fun to see. So I guess stay tuned, right? And then we'll be able to look at area-based fishing restrictions through this mapping of either hypothetical future fishing effort or actualized fishing effort. Now, you can alter that contact index that's in the model. Say we assume that the raised foot rope trawl only contacts like 10% or 5% of the sweep is in contact with the bottom at any given time, but we're assuming that 95% of the sweep is in contact with a generic otter trawl. Well, what would the fishery look like if we required everybody to use a raised foot rope trawl? I'm being very hypothetical here. But you can go back and recompute the model and tell what the change in area swept is and the change in SASI units might be, and you can look at whether that has any sort of a benefit whatsoever, and then you could actually look at the cost associated with that potentially and have some objective basis for making rational decisions on alternatives to minimize to the adverse effects of fishing on EFH to the extent practicable. All right. And this also gives us a tool for doing adverse effects assessments in FMPs. You know, right now, when I get a new framework or amendment to do an assessment on, it's kind of, we don't have a real objective tool that we can use across all the different FMPs, and you end up kind of, that looks like it might have an adverse effect on fishing or on EFH, and we kind of talk about why, and it's all a little bit ad hoc. So this might hopefully provide us with something that we can use going forward in multiple fisheries or multiple FMPs. And so here's the timeline. Again, the SSC reviewed all of this in March. And the major problems with it at the time were there was no biological or prey habitat features incorporated. And likewise, on the maps that I showed of the realized fishing effort and that sort of thing, and the numbers, there's no biological or prey in there. Those numbers are very similar to the ones that we presented to the SSC in March. The PDT has not yet finished filling out the matrices to calculate those omega values based on the biological and prey species. So we are incorporating those. We've come up with a way to incorporate those as per the SSC's direction, and we're in the process of building that up. And then the incorporation of heterogeneity, of averaging out some of the dominant substrates that the gear is likely to impact, that's another major change since the SSC reviewed this. They're going to review it again in the fall, I think, September, I hope. And at that point, we hope, the PDT hopes, that this model will be ready to spit out some results and we'll have some sensitivity runs and we'll be able to provide the council and the committee with an assessment of how good a tool we think we have. And then it'll be up to you all to figure out if you agree or not, assuming the SSC agrees with us. And with that, I think that's it.
Paul Howard.
Thanks, Chad. I'm trying to get a connection between, say, running the model with the most vulnerable habitat and effort beforehand and coming up with a conclusion, and what is my conclusion from running that model, compared to we have HAPCs, now let's run the model on those HAPCs. I don't have a connection between habitat area of particular concern and vulnerable habitat.
Almost as if I paid you to say that. There is no connection right now, and we set it up on purpose that way. Right? We didn't think that we should presuppose where the areas were likely to be vulnerable. We wanted to take an objective look at what data we had, at the literature, at what the literature says about the impacts of GEERS, using a tremendous amount of best professional judgment from the PDT, and kind of starting with a fresh slate. What we might find is that the areas that had been chosen as HAPCs in phase one are, you know, kind of emerged from our spatial model as areas that are likely to be vulnerable to fishing activities or not. But either way, I don't think it undermines what the council did in phase one because, I mean, the people that voted on those HAPCs obviously agreed with the then PDT's assessment of their merit as HAPCs. And they serve a very valuable environmental protection role and a consultation role. They elevate the importance of a chunk of bottom in that non-fishing realm. If they also emerge from our separate assessment that's specific to fishing impacts, all the better. Then there may be some reason to take fishery management action specific to those HAPCs. And there may not be. But I don't think that undermines the work that the council has already done on the HAPCs.
Another more philosophical question. As you know, there, I think Dr. Lubchenco announced the formation of or that she would be a member of a marine spatial planning task force. So I guess down the line, we're going to have to think about how our habitat protection efforts from the impact of fishing might change legally, legislatively, when we're now separating out zones or zoning. So it might, this would play a great role in that, by the way, but we might have to think a little differently down the line.
Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, I've got a couple of questions, Chad. First of all, I realize a lot of variables are used in the model, and a lot of great work has been done by the model creators to get it to this particular point in time. To what extent has flume tank work, all that video work, been helpful in getting some assessment of the amount of bottom contact of the foot rope, the sweep, all of that, the parts of the net that so far are considered to be hard on the bottom, let's say?
Well, there's two ways. One, I mean, one of the things that I did when we first started trying to parameterize this contact index was go through and look at the literature, and also on the angle of the doors and the angle of the ground cables. I mean, when Steve Ayers from GMRI, who's in the audience now and whom I might throw into the bus at any moment, came up with this idea, he had a very wide, it was like 10 degrees to 20 degrees for the ground cables, and I'm trying to think of what it was for the doors, but it was another, you know, it was a fairly wide angle, and it matters, you know, not so much on the doors because they're pretty small, but on the ground cables it matters tremendously because they're very long, and if you take 15 degrees and you make it, 20 degrees or 25 degrees, you're going to change your effective linear width considerably. So I went to the literature to see if anybody had done any work on this stuff, and it turns out there's a couple of different models that have been used to model these parameters. And there was one paper in particular that I'm thinking of where they compared the results of the theoretical models, which were based on divers and studies and net menstruation devices and that stuff, and they looked at flume tanks as well as a ground truth for that. And it's those studies that I used to come up with that hard 15 degrees and 40 degrees. So that's one way that's been incorporated. And the other is because the guy who created this monster, Steve Ayers, whom I just threw under the bus, has been to a lot of flume tanks and seen how the gear works. And the back and forth between the PDT at four different PDT meetings now on trying to get everybody up to speed to have the same conception of how the gear interacts with the bottom has been really critical. And if we didn't have people on the PDT that have seen the gear in action, have dove on the gear, have worked with all the net menstruation technology that's out there and have seen the flume tanks, we would have no prayer. We have watched some video and stuff, but we're relying heavily on the expertise of our members.
One other point. In one of the tables you provided, you showed from 1996 through 2008 for trawls and scallop dredges, the contact adjusted AS, and then the SASE. Okay. Hours fish revenue, all of that. Now, for interpretation, when I look at that particular table, am I to interpret it this way? In 1996, the SASI, the SASE, was about 94,000 square kilometers. In 2008, it dropped down to about 37,600 square kilometers. Does that mean that the adverse effect of fishing was reduced by 2/3? Key words here being adverse effects. Is that how this table is supposed to be interpreted? Has the model been crafted in such a way that when we get these numbers, we should consider it to be adverse impact?
Yes and yes, with the caveat that these numbers are no good. This is just an example, right? Right now we don't have the biological habitat or the prey habitat features incorporated in here. So they're heavily biased to just the substrates. Now, of course, because we're inferring the features to the substrates, it's a substrate-biased model. And we also, these numbers have not incorporated the decay function over time. So this is going to change a lot over the next few months. But that is exactly how it is intended to be read. Put okay. Faith in the theory, but not the numbers.
Okay. I'm still struggling with how we are to consider this to be an assessment of adverse impact. What can you point us to that would enable us to capture all the work by the plan development team relative to that very important descriptor, adverse?
Well, one of the cool things about being as specific as we are through all the steps of this is you can go back, for example, to those matrices that have the susceptibility and recovery values, and you can look at, okay, which combination of gear, substrate, biological feature, had a very high number, and which ones had a very low number, and how did we derive these composite omega values? So the matrix is the place to go to look at how this is all getting set up. That's where you'll see which combinations of substrate, biota, and prey, and gear are susceptible, and recovery, the fast or slow.
All right, thank you. And I have one other question, because I see Ron Smaller was sitting in the audience behind you. He reminded me that Ron has provided, a member of the plant development team, maybe the whole team has got it now, but a very interesting video showing the reaction of the burrowing sea anemones to oncoming gear. And, of course, these cerianthid sea anemones, they just swift all the way down into their tubes. Has that particular visual information, that particular video, had any impact on the model itself relative to the impact of fishing gear in mud bottoms, those sorts of substrates where we would find these burrowing anemones? And the only reason why I mention that is that they continue to attract a great deal of attention relative to the impact of fishing in mud bottom. It seems to be focused almost entirely on those particular sea anemones as adverse impact. So to what extent has that information been useful, if at all?
Oh, it's to a great extent. I mean, there's not a lot of data on that sort of thing. And certainly there's not a lot of video, but it's I think that gets a little bit of airplay because it's kind of a cool thing. You know, these things ducking before the gear gets to them. It's a neat theory, and it's really cool to watch. I actually haven't seen the video, so I'm assuming it's cool to watch. But we're looking at the structure-forming component of habitat and the reduction in functional value of that structure. So to the extent that a gear passes over a chunk of real estate and the structure is unchanged, then that's going to get a very low susceptibility and, recovery becomes irrelevant, right? If it's not susceptible, there is no recovery. And so the matrices are feature-based, so we'll be able to look at that exact feature and give a very definitive. We'll give a specific number to it for susceptibility and recovery in high energy and low energy. And any and all kind of pieces of data are factored into it.
David.
Yeah, I wanted to just say a little something about, speak to Paul's question and to David's as well on this kind of philosophical aspect of this. I mean, we're waiting to see the various runs of the model. So, for example, if you would assume in an area where hard coral is present that you would get a very, bad score, if you will, that, towing through there would produce bad results. Conversely, you go to, say, the northwest corner of Middle Bank where 50 boats tow day after day after day after day after day after day and catch ton after ton after ton after ton of fish, that you should see a pretty low score because obviously it hasn't changed anything. But we haven't got that yet because we haven't got all those runs yet. And the other point was to the gear questions, the model assumptions on page 7, I think it says slide number 25. Those are, the committee's accepted these as acceptable approximations of reality. Are they absolutely real? No. You could probably quibble with every one of them. But because what we're doing here is probably 10 orders of magnitude better than anything that's ever been done before, and you can't have 5,000 variables, you'll never get anywhere. You had to start someplace, and so we've assigned constant assumptions to the gear when all of us who actually work with the gear know that, in fact, none of these are absolutely constant. But these are good approximations.
Anything further? Anyone else? Dave?
Okay, thank you. I think that Dave Gaethel just said something very important. We know that it's not perfect. Nothing's ever going to be perfect, but it is, as he pointed out, 10,000 orders of magnitude better than anything we've ever had before. And that's exactly the point that Steve Cadron made after the peer review, and I asked him specifically about just that. And he's, I said, is this really, what we're doing here, is this really something good? And he said, good. He said, it's a breakthrough. He said, it's the first thing of its type that's ever been done. We've never had this kind of a model in order to rate the effective gear in the bottom. And I'd like to point out, as I've pointed this out before, but I want to point it out again, we manage with the precautionary approach, which means that the less we know, the more precautions we have to take and the more closures you get. I know some people have thought, oh, this is just another tool to close places down. Actually, it's a tool to open places up. And I think it needs to be seen in that light. The more information we get, the better the model. Then the less precautionary we have to be, and the more areas it will be open. And I see it that way, and I want to make sure that it's understood in that way. The model also, with time, is self-correcting, because as we improve the data, as we get more data, the model gets better. So it improves with time. And I think that's an important point, that it continues to be self-correcting. And the other thing Steve Cajun said was that our choices between having some kind of a metric of this sort, that self-correction gets better with time, or continuing to have an irrelevant political battle every time we have to make a decision on a fisheries action. So that's the spirit in which this was done. I want it to be seen that way. The SSC review was extraordinarily helpful and did point out some weaknesses and some places that we needed to move, and that's basically what the last couple of months have been spent doing. So we were hoping to get a model run by this time, but in fact what we did was we strengthened the basis of the entire model is what it turned out to be. It's a mammoth project. It went far beyond anything that I had anticipated when we started this. The other thing it does is it leads us into this model will be essential as we move on to develop an ecosystem management program, which it's pretty evident now that's where we're going to go. It's the intent of the agency to do so. It's our intent to do so. And as we move into ecosystem-based management, there are a couple of fundamental decisions we're going to have to make right at the beginning so that we don't spend too much time going down the wrong roads. So I at the last PDT meeting, at the end of it, I asked the PDT to be thinking in general terms about what kind of very basic principles an ecosystem management plan would have to be formed on. And there's two directions we can go with this. And One of the things that we faced at the very beginning with this SASE model was what are we trying to accomplish in terms of what the bottom is supposed to look like? Do we want to reproduce 1492 or 1850, or what is it we want to make it look like? And I think that's an important thing to bear in mind as we move forward. What is it we're trying to do? And there are really two directions we can go with ecosystem management, which is where this obviously is leading. We can go in the direction of that leads us more towards a population homeostasis approach, where we take our single species management and just adapt it to multiple species using kind of a sort of like the pistons in an engine. One goes up, the other goes down. And that's one way of doing it. It's static in concept. And it, again, it involves pick a date. What are you trying to achieve? The other potential way that we can go is to use a productivity model. And that hasn't been done before, and that's breaking new ground. But in doing a productivity model, we'll be looking at the energy flow through the food web. And fortunately, we have Mike Fogarty and his group in this area that's doing exactly that work right now. That's dynamic in concept to go in that direction. And instead of pick a date, you're picking an outcome. What do we want? What kind of productivity do we want to have? Are we looking for the maximum benefit, economic benefit to the nation? We can go that way. And those are all the decisions that we're going to have to make at the beginning. We've alluded to ecosystem-based fishery management. We've stated our intent to move in that direction. There are a lot of new studies being done right now and papers coming out on how to do it. And we're in this agency, we're setting up workshops. And I have asked the PDT to begin brainstorming that. But what we haven't done, and I'd like to do, and I've got a motion to that effect, which I'd like to have put up. I'd like to move that the Council direct the Habitat MPA Ecosystems Committee to begin drafting a proposal for an ecosystem-based fishery management plan as soon as practicable, which means that they're not going to start it tomorrow, but it's our intention to move this in that direction. And I think that the SASE model is something which helps us to lead in that direction. And I'd like to have direction for the committee, and that's why I'm proposing that the council give us that task. I think the council should be tasking these committees anyway, and that's why I want to move this way.
This isn't a committee motion, right?
No, it is not.
Is there a second? Seconded by Dave Gaethel. Discussion. Paul Howard.
Dave, we had a discussion at the council chairs meeting about what is everyone doing for ecosystem-based management. And we found out that they're all doing different things. And the biggest concern we had was, you know, we need guidance from Silver Spring to say what should be in our plans.
Mm-hmm.
And that... And so we recommend that there be some guidance on what should be in it. And the second thing is, you know, we're having this ecosystem workshop, and that hopefully we'll get, you know, some real input from our SSC. So I guess my feeling is that, you know, we are going to, and I think the ecosystem plan was supposed to start in 2010 if it makes the next priority. That was the plan for 2010 to start. But I think this is jumping the gun a little. I'd certainly like to see us get done with the omnibus amendment before we even start thinking about this.
Yeah, that was my intent. That's why I worded it as a draft, not a plan, but a proposal as soon as practicable, which would be after this is put to bed. But it's just the idea of having a direction. Maybe we don't even need a motion. If it's just the intent of the council that we move in that direction, that's fine. So at any rate, I'll leave it out there and see what happens.
Any further discussion? Dr. Pierce.
I appreciate David's motivation and, of course, Paul's comments. I don't have it in front of me, but I thought that this council had pretty much decided to go in this direction a while back. And so we've already stated our intent to go there. The question is how fast and what data do we have in hand to make that leap? And clearly, from the discussions that we've just had, the presentation we've just received, some significant progress has been made, and we are going in that direction. And maybe after what Paul says has happened, we have that workshop and other ecosystem-related initiatives, we will be able to then have the committee jump into it with both feet and give us some, you know, something to look at. But I don't think it's necessary for us to state this as you have it now. We've already done it, David, I believe.
Anyone else on the council? Sally?
Yeah, I'll support the motion, and even agreeing with what Dr. Pierce just said, that the council has said that this is something that is desired, but it's gone beyond the back burner for several years. So I think it's worth putting out there again. But with one question, you know, as I was listening to this, I was kind of waiting for the punchline, the last slide in the discussion of the timeline. And I mean, this is certainly not the fault of staff or the current chair, perhaps the former chair of the Habitat Committee, if anyone. But it's going to end up taking a total of 7 years to finish this amendment, and it's huge and it's groundbreaking and it's you know, important to get the details right. But Magnuson guidelines on essential fish habitats say that councils should review their EFH designations every 5 years. So my question is related to this motion is, number one, I assume that this means that we're going to, as Paul said, get the job done on the omnibus amendment and then turn the attention to this approach, so that we actually make sure that we are compliant with the basic Magnuson requirements for dealing with essential fish habitat.
Terry.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very supportive of the rationale behind this motion, but I think it's, as Paul and David said, a little ahead of its time. I'd feel more comfortable about having some specific guidance after the workshop. We've talked about endorsing these concepts for a while now, and it, as a member of the committee, I don't know really what it's telling me.
Chad?
I just wanted to I had an interesting conversation with Silver Springs a couple of weeks ago on that five-year review timeline issue, and hopefully it will be put into guidance to the councils at some point, but the five-year review is not intended to require an EIS or an EA. It's a review, and it can be an internal review. So that five-year review, and I was kind of surprised to learn this, is not intended to drive the management actions. So I only offer that because I'm not sure that the five-year review is a good reason to make any decisions.
Anything further before I call the question? Dave?
Yeah, the intent here is basically because I want to be able to say to the PDT, this is where we're going, and since the SASE model and what we're doing right now leads into this, I want you to be able to be thinking in the back of your minds that this is definitely the reason behind it, or that this is part of the trajectory of where we're going in terms of coming up at the end of all of this with a usable ecosystem management plan that's based on something other than saying, well, yeah, we're doing ecosystems, but has that changed your tax in any way, your way of looking at tax? And find out the answer is no, because that's what often happens. So it's just the idea of being able to have the PDT thinking in terms of what you're doing now as part of a continuum. That was the reasoning behind the motion.
Okay, you ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Nine. Opposed? Eight. The motion carries 9-8. Okay, anything else on our habitat? Chad, I just had a quick question. When are you going to load the biological and the prey into the model?
Yeah, the PT's got the matrices, and the way we're going to do it, everybody goes back and figures it all out themselves. We come back and we talk about it, make sure everybody's on the same page with regard to what it means, what each feature means, what a pass of the gear means, et cetera, et cetera. And then the PDT in plenary is going to come up with the final numbers for each of the matrix cells. So that is going to happen at the next PDT meeting for both the biological and the prey. We can go back and plug those numbers into the model.
And the source documents or data sets for those two inputs, the biological and the prey, those are being developed or they've already been decided upon?
Already been decided upon.
Okay. Thank you. Anything further, Mary Beth?
Thank you. Just one question. I've expressed my concerns about the model assumptions before, and I think Dave characterized what the answer to those concerns have been. But I think it's going to continue to be an issue, particularly for fishermen, if you see it laid out in this fashion. So I'm just curious if you have engaged with the AP at all on this issue. I think because it's complicated and takes a bit to get into it, I think you need to be, you know, checking in with them on a periodic basis, and I was wondering if that had been done.
I think that the next, I'm not sure it's reflected on here all that well, but the next committee meeting, was it supposed to be a joint committee and AP meeting? Wasn't that right? Or is it the following one? Yes. I'm glad I'm not the only one that remembers it this way, but we were going to have a joint meeting with the AP. The intent, the PDT wants feedback on all of this stuff, specifically from the AP, as we have from the committee and the public all along. And the intent was to do that at a joint meeting, a two-day meeting of the committee and the AP. I'm just not mentally clear on when the timing is. Apologize for that.
Gene Martin.
Yeah, with respect to the last motion that just passed, is that intended to be an omnibus, an amendment that will amend all of the FMPs, or how is that going to work? Have you thought through that?
To be defined through scoping and other mechanisms.
Okay.
Paul.
That's exactly the point. Everyone's got their own idea of what an ecosystem based plan is. So I think we need guidance from Silver Spring. What does one look like? And what should we be putting into it and stuff like that? But so we don't know what it is.
Okay, anything further under habitat? Okay, let me go right into interspecies.